This is Dave Crippen, and today is June 5th, 1985. We're at the Design History Center, and this is one of our interviews in our Design History Oral Reminiscences series. We are talking today with Mr. Paul W. Gillan, G-I-L-L-A-N, who is a well-known and long-time had a long career at General Motors in the design department. Mr. Gillan will give us his career narrative in his own way, at his own pace.
All right, Dave, we're all set. Did you want to know something about my background?
Yes, please.
My educational background?
Please.
And perhaps what we were talking about before is
exactly.
A boy, how I started out?
In some detail, yes.
Well, when I was very, very young, I was always interested in drawing, and I became involved in the Young Artists and Writers Club that the Detroit News had many, many years ago. And at that time, I had several pictures published in the Detroit News. And for a little kid of seven, why, of course, that gave me a great emphasis to continue my work. So I did a lot of drawing. I've always been interested in cars, probably because my dad's had cars from way back in the early days. And he's done a lot of work on them, and my grandfather over in Canada used to have a carriage building company and a blacksmith shop over there many years ago.
Where was that?
And that was in London.
In London?
Yes.
Yeah,
I guess it's about 150 miles.
He built carriages?
He built carriages over there, and they used to, in those days, I've seen pictures that my dad has shown me, in those days they used to have a ramp up to the top of the building, and of course they didn't have fast drying paints like they do today, so they'd have to, my dad's job was to go up there with a sprinkling can and water the whole thing down, and then a little while later, when the dust settled, water it again. Then when the carriages were taken up there and painted, they'd have to be painted it would take about 15 to 18 days to paint a carriage, because they'd have to put several coats of paint on. In those days, there weren't any dryers in the paints, so they just air drying at their natural time. Why it took a long time as a result. But I was always interested in automobiles and drawing them, painting them, that sort of thing. Then I attended, I was born in Detroit. I attended Southeastern High School. And then I went to Wayne University, where I took art, design, and advertising. And then in the evenings, I was also interested in all sorts of advertising, because I knew you have to know a lot about clothes and how they hang and this sort of thing, because I thought at that time I'd be an illustrator. Illustration was a big thing in those days. So at night, while I was attending Wayne University in the daytime, in the evening, I went down to Cass Tech, and there I took fashion illustration and more art courses. Then when I finished those, and I continued at Wayne, and then I switched over to evenings at Wayne and got a job at Standard Accident Insurance Company. My folks knew an executive down there, and they thought it'd be good for me to get some business training, and maybe it would get me away from the art line a little bit.
They were a little unsure of that.
They were, because the artists traditionally haven't always made the best living. So
probably supposed to starve.
Yeah, a lot of them did, and it was kind of tough to find a job. But of course, in those days, if you could get a job as an illustrator, illustrators made very, very good money. So, and I was interested in that sort of thing.
How did you do at Wayne? Were your instructors encouraging? And,
oh yes, very.
Do you remember any particular ones that?
Well, there was Ralph Gross was one of the men that.
Very, very good.
Designer and artist,
and encourage you to go ahead.
Encouraged me to continue on,
really?
And so I did, and I liked it. I also had an uncle who encouraged me, because he was in the railroad business, and he was a little older, and he was saying at the time that when you can get in railroad, or you can get in insurance or some other type of business, and you may do quite well financially at it, but it could be very, very dull, and it's the type of thing that knowing my background, that he just thought that it wouldn't be the thing for me. So as a result, I liked the art business. And at that time, then I tried to get a job over at Chrysler's while I was working at Standard Axe Insurance Company. I went over there to try to get a job as an automobile designer. And I took some samples over.
Who did you talk to? Remember?
Golly, I don't even remember the fella's name.
What year was this?
This was in 19, well, it was before, just before I went into the service, so it had to be 1941.
Mm-hmm.
And they took my samples, and they looked at them and made all sorts of comments, and they were encouraging, took my name, application, and so on. But about that time, they were talking about conscripting all the fellows for the service.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a war on yet, but it rather looked as though there would be. So they put my name in a hat with the rest of them, and I was one of the early ones drawn.
Really?
So in August 1941, before there was a war, I went into the service for supposedly 6 months of training. While I was in there, they extended that to 18 months of training.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, by December, war broke out, and I was in for 4.5 years then at that time.
What data were you in?
What
did you do? Were you in the U.S. Army?
I was in the Army. I started out in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
They started me out in the infantry. Nearly everybody went in the infantry or artillery then.
Mm-hmm.
And then war broke out, and they shipped the whole group up to San Francisco, up to Presidio. We were just up there to get our indoctrination and mosquito netting and the rest of the thing to go over to the Pacific. And most of the fellows I trained with did. However, they were looking for a cadre to put into the intelligence group in San Francisco, and I was one of those chosen by my qualifications. So I worked in there for a while, and it was a 16-hour day because we were very, very busy. That was headquarters 4th Army at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I heard about a new unit that was going to be activated down in the federal building, and that was the 12th Naval District headquarters. And they needed somebody in the intelligence department down there who had a background in art and knew something about mechanical drawing and this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was one of those selected. So I went down to work for the Navy. I was then transferred to the Navy.
Right.
And a lot of my family and relatives in Detroit thought there must be something the matter because you have to be thoroughly investigated, and all of them were required to say what they knew about my background.
Mm-hmm.
And but I got into this group, and then I was very, very lucky because, well, part of the time it was around-the-clock working arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
I was then put on commutations and rations and given an allowance and lived at a civilian hotel in San Francisco.
Right.
And that was very, very nice.
Yeah.
So I was working for the Navy, and I liked it very much. And mostly it was at that time, it was the collection and dissemination of all sorts of information, this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot of interesting work. But while I was there, it also gave me an opportunity to do freelance artwork in my spare time. Because living right downtown and being single, you just can't get along on what the Army gives you to work with. And I was dating quite a bit at the time because I was working with a lot of gals over at the federal building. So, and then in the afternoon at the hotel, when I get off, I'd go up to the roof and we'd sunbathe up on the roof. It was a very, very nice arrangement. I liked that.
Mm-hmm.
Had a good time. But I did need more money, so then I got into the art business doing a lot of freelance artwork around San Francisco. And it was easy at the time because some of the best artists were all in the service,
right,
and I didn't have a difficult time getting work.
What type of commissions did you get?
Well, I did all sorts of drawings and paintings, but they went in the cable cars and buses and, you know, these cards that they put on the inside.
The advertising.
Yeah, that sort of thing.
Right. Uh-huh.
And billboards, a couple of billboards I did there for the Diamond Palace Jewelry Company right there on Market Street in San Francisco.
Yeah.
So, this was great. I liked it. But at the same time, I still liked the automobile business and thought when I got out, I might like to make some samples while I was in the service. So when I got out of the service, I would be able to take the samples around and conceivably get into advertising, or if not, into the automobile business. And I was, I tried very different times to get into the Air Force. I wanted to be a flyer, but I couldn't because of my eyesight. And they said the only thing that you'll ever do is probably fly a kite because you can't make it in the service as a fire. So I didn't make that. Anyway, the time went on and on, and I had a good time out there, met a lot of interesting people, did a lot of nice things. And
did you get some contacts in the design and advertising worlds as well?
I did, as far as San Francisco in California, if I wanted to continue on out there. And I had every hope of continuing on in California.
Mm-hmm.
I knew three people out there that wanted to invest in an advertising agency with me. In Southern Cal, which would have been a nice thing. But as soon as the war was over, I returned home to see my folks and collect my gear, and then thought I'd go back to the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
But my brother, meantime, had been a finance officer over, younger brother, finance officer over in North Africa, flying around auditing the various airfields, and he got a bad case of yellow jaundice or whatever they call it.
Yeah.
And so he was in the hospital there. He was sent back to the hospital in Philadelphia and flown from there to Chicago. Mm-hmm. And he just had about a 60-40 chance of living. His chance is not being very good at all. So consequently, when I returned to Detroit, I would want to go over to see him on the weekends. Mm-hmm. So in order to sustain myself, I went out looking for a job. Mm-hmm. And I went to a couple of advertising agencies. And one I went to in the General Motors building said, well, the type of thing you've got here with these automobiles and so on, you ought to go over to see Harley Earl over in the General Motors building, mm-hmm. because you'd be a good designer. And well, that pleased me that they thought of me in that light. So I went over to the GM building, and that's where I first got out of the service. That was in December 1945. I went over to the General Motors building, took some samples over, and met Harley Earl. And because he was from California, and I had a lot of flamboyant things in there, including a lot of pictures of girls and this sort of thing. And this rather appealed to him, I think maybe even more so than the girls that I did on the automobiles. Mm-hmm. But then I had a California scene in there that I did, of what I proposed for an advertising agency for myself in North Hollywood at the time. Mm-hmm. And because at that time, going out the Sunset Strip, it wasn't built up as it is today. There was plenty of vacant space out there, and I thought it'd be a nice place to put up a building and had an ad agency. So I did a nice architectural rendering of this and put in some automobiles around there, and Earl was very interested in these, particularly the California background. Mm-hmm. So he hired me. And then I started in...
Before you leave, mm-hmm. Harley Earl, what's your impression of Mr. Earl? Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of your first impression of Harley Earl?
With my drawings in there. Well, first I had to see a man who was an assistant of his, and he was in charge of the design up there. His name was Jules Andrade.
Oh, yes, I've heard of him. He was his assistant.
He was an assistant in charge of design. Howard O'Leary was his
business
associate and business assistant.
Right.
So I went in, and they called, I saw Jules first, uh-huh. before I could see Harley Earl, and then Jules said, he would stutter a little bit. Did you see Mr. Earl? So okay, he took him in, he came back and said, you'd like to come in and meet Mr. Earl. So I went in, then he had a Howard O'Leary in there also. So I talked to all three of them, and you said, what's my first impression of Harley Earl? Well, he was a huge man, great big tall fellow, very, very well dressed, and he could be very engaging when you weren't working for him directly, or when he first met you, mm-hmm. and he made a very, very good impression as far as I was concerned. He's very, very courteous, and to a young fellow going in, why, naturally you're a bit impressed with someone who might be your potential boss to
sure.
begin with, so you...
Had you known of his Hollywood background?
I didn't know anything about his Hollywood background, but before I went into the service, he had done a couple of special cars, and the photographs of those were in the Detroit News.
Oh, yeah.
And I clipped those out, I put them in a scrapbook I had, as I did with all special cars at that time. In fact, I still have those in a scrapbook at home. And so I was very impressed with that, and we talked a bit about that car. They called it the Y Job at the time,
uh-huh.
and it was a Buick automobile. And the car that I did in my California painting that I described was an adaptation of this Y Job,
uh-huh.
but it was a convertible, and it was a three-quarter front view looking down, and the car had, instead of the pipes coming out of the exhaust pipes coming out of the side of the hood, I had them coming out of the plan view of the rear fender,
mm-hmm.
and it was quite a striking car. It was black and red, and then the interior of the car was a combination of red leather with the surrounds done in zebra skin, black and white zebra skin,
mm-hmm.
which is flamboyant and probably not so great in the taste element, but it did appeal to him at the time because it was a very attractive picture.
Mm-hmm.
But I was impressed, and I was very happy to work there. So usually when they get a person in who'd never worked there before, they started them out in an area they call 40 Milwaukee, which was an indoctrination center for young aspiring designers.
Mm-hmm.
And that was run by a man at that time named Ned Nichols. And
tell us about Ned Nichols. You've heard a lot about him.
Have you heard a lot about Ned Nichols?
Yes. Well, not a lot.
Yeah.
I know something about him, but I think you could add to our knowledge of him. What was he doing at the time?
Well, Ned Nichols was running Ford Milwaukee at the time that I started mm-hmm. over there.
Right.
And when I first started
was
General
that
Motors.
A research, design research area?
No, that was an area to train aspiring young designers.
Ah, okay.
And there were a lot of young people around. In fact, Irv Rubicki, who's now, who got Bill Mitchell's job over there, is now VP,
uh-huh.
and used to be in my, an assistant of mine, is was in at Ford Milwaukee at the time. And Ned yeah, Nichols yeah. tells me that at the time, Irv really wasn't all that great. And he wasn't, he never had any art training, a lot
mm-hmm.
of art training, so that's why
yeah.
he was at Ford Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
And Ned said that they went over there and took a look at his work, and Jules Andrade said, you know, Ned, I don't think this kid's got it. I really think we ought to let him go, and he just, I don't think he's going to develop.
Mm-hmm.
He's talking about Irv Rubicki.
Yeah.
And Ned tells me that he said, well, Jules, let's keep him on a little while longer, because he didn't have as many kids in there, if he lost one, it didn't make his job as important. So he thought, keep Irv on. So he said, well, I can see that he's got a little potential. Let's keep him on for a while. Let's give him a little try. So they kept Irv on. And this was, as a result, direct result of Ned Nichols' encouragement.
How did Mr. Nichols like your work?
Mr. Nichols never liked any work but his own. No, I don't say that facetiously, but it, pretty much that's the way he was, because he had a very good impression of his work and his design ability,
mm-hmm.
and rightfully so. He's a very, very good designer.
Mm-hmm.
He's a much better designer than he is an artist,
mm-hmm.
in my estimation.
Mm-hmm.
His people were always too big for the automobiles and this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But another thing, while you mentioned Ned Nichols, an interesting thing there. One time, Earl decided it would be a good idea to get his people to travel a bit, get them out in the world and see a few things, meet people, and it does broaden the horizons. And when you do that, he decided a good place for us to go is to California. So he sent a group of us out there. He sent out Bill Lang, Claire McKeegan, and Ned Nichols, myself, Ed Glowacki, and G-L-O-W-A-C-K-E, Ed Glowacki. He was running Cadillac at that time,
mm-hmm.
successor of Bill Mitchell in Cadillac Studio. So Earl thought it'd be a good idea if we went out to California. So Howard O'Leary set it all up. We flew to Los Angeles. He arranged for us to have cars to drive there. And there was a guy by the name of Hall out there who was the Buick dealer. So we went and took a cab over to Hall's place. And he got us Buicks to drive when we were out there, and we saw a lot of California. Enjoyed it very, very much.
Mm-hmm.
Put us up at the Beverly Hills Hotel. We had very, very nice accommodations there. Good expense accounts. Everybody had the finest meals, got loaded every night. Then from there, we went down to San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
Had a good time at San Diego. But what I was going to get to with Ned Nichols was that in Los Angeles, we went out to Art Center School,
mm-hmm.
and we were all to give a little dissertation to the group of design students there on our backgrounds, and also a critique on a lot of their designs and artwork. And Ned Nichols at that time had been up a lot of the night, because at that time he was rather heavy boozer,
mm-hmm.
and he was up a lot of the night. So the next morning he said to the group that it's great for you fellas to be out here working, but he says, my particular case, I never went to art school in my life, and I made it. Now, this is a great thing, you know, to say to a group of young fellas who saved since they were 12 years old to go to art school and thought that's the only way to get in.
Mm.
And, of course, nowadays it is. But Ned, in that regard, didn't have all the tact that he might have.
Mm.
But he's a great guy. He's a nice guy. At General Motors, he went from Ford Milwaukee to become chief designer of Buick. And he was a bachelor, great big, tall fellow, balding,
mm-hmm.
and he always had special Buicks. The Buick people liked him very, very much.
Oh.
In fact, it'd be a good idea if sometime you could get Ned in here, because he could give you a good background, not just on the design aspect of General Motors, but if you want a General Motors background, also on the Buick management.
Oh.
Harlow Curtis,
yes.
Ed Ragsdale, and the
mm-hmm.
fellows who were running the organization at that
yeah.
time. Curtis, of course, later going on to become president of GM.
Mm-hmm.
They thought a great deal of Ned Nichols. He could do no wrong,
mm-hmm.
because he used to go up every Saturday morning, and that entire group used to play cards at one of the downtown hotels in Flint.
Uh-huh.
And Ned was pretty good, I understand, playing cards. And they had their poker games up there, which lasted all day and half the night. So he was in pretty tight with that
mm-hmm.
group. That would probably be an interesting story
mm-hmm.
in itself.
But there you are at 40 Milwaukee, did you say?
40 Milwaukee, that was,
which
was about a block away from the General Motors building on Milwaukee.
And that was your training, that was the training center for young
designers. That was the training center for young designers. I didn't go there. They put me directly into a Oldsmobile studio.
Oh, good. Well, let's develop
Working for Art Ross at the time.
How did that happen? You're a fledgling designer, and who decided that you should go right into a
Harley Earl decided
studio.
I should go right into the studio.
Very good.
Because, well, see, a lot of these other fellows didn't have much of an art background.
Right.
And some of their work was... frankly, it wasn't all that good.
Mm-hmm.
And they had design ability, and they could come up with designs, but their presentations were bad.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to make presentations to top people at the corporation,
sure.
You better put up some presentations that look professional.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times, they could get artists, professional artists, who could do a very good job, but they couldn't design.
Mm-hmm.
But if you had a combination of both things, well, you were in, and that's what helped me at the time. So I went in to work for Art Ross.
Art Ross was the
chief designer
at Oldsmobile.
Yeah, for Oldsmobile Studio.
Studio.
Yes. Yes.
Where is that located?
Well,
the studio
the studios themselves at that time were located in the GM Research Building,
mm-hmm.
which is on Milwaukee Avenue. Large. It's now GM Photographic. A large building directly behind the GM building, and it was connected by a bridge
mm-hmm.
across up on the ninth floor, I believe,
mm-hmm.
from the GM building. So I went in to work for Art Ross.
And when was this, by the way?
That was in January 1946. So.
Can you sort of sketch this for us in some detail the atmosphere of an established studio with a chief designer and you as a junior designer coming into a studio? How did that work? What were your experiences?
Well, when you entered the studio, at that time, the studios were, it was a first of all, the design department up there at that time was one great big open section.
Sort of a bullpen type thing?
Well, it was one great big open section because this was immediately following the war.
Yeah.
And during the war, as I understand, they took down all of the partitions, and this was a great big drafting facility. So this was immediately after the war.
Uh-huh.
So what they did was they didn't have all the permanent walls up at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So they had huge boards on wheels in separating the various studios and
uh-huh.
comprising the studios. Each studio was very, very large. But there wasn't the degree of security that they would like to have had at that particular time immediately after the war. So I went into old studio, met Art Ross. Art was a dapper little guy, and had a mustache, and you hear all sorts of things about artists and artistic types and this sort of thing. So Art sat me down across from me and said, "Kid, do you like girls?" And he put his hand on my knee, and I thought, "Oh, oh my God, what'd I get into?" And then, but I didn't have anything to worry about,
because
Art did like girls, so I was all set. And so I said, "Well, yes, naturally." I picked that up. "Yes, yes, I found you." And he says, "Good, good." He said, "That's the kind of guy I like." So that was on safe ground there.
Some questions those days that artists were gay.
Well, I guess there is sometimes with an artistic type, you think he could be gay and this sort of thing. And I'd never had any experience working with an art group before.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't have to worry about that in the automobile design group because it's mechanically oriented. And usually in the mechanically oriented area, they don't have as much of that sort of activity. Although later they did, I understand, in the interior group out at the tech center. Yes. Some of the fellows out there, I think, were. But at any rate, I was working in Oldsmobile Studio.
So you did it all very well with Mr. Ross.
I got along okay with Art, yeah. He was had a lot of eccentricities. His idea was to work all day, work hard, then work overtime. He'd go out about 4 o'clock, 4:30, 5 o'clock to dinner, wouldn't get back till 8:30. We were still working there. Then he'd want to sit down and regale us with all of his experiences and background. Hell, we all wanted to get home, and we've been working all day. And at that time, they didn't pay you overtime. They'd only give you a dollar for your dinner at night. And
you'd have to go out and scrounge around on the boulevard, kind of restaurants.
Yeah, look around. That we're up in the boulevard.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Grand Boulevard, Woodward area,
yeah.
Cass Avenue area, and so a lot of time those days the fellas go over and maybe have a drink. A lot of them like to have a drink with dinner. Well, it costs you well over your dollar allowance just for the drink. But that's the time that I met a lot of interesting people up there. I met Dick Teague was in Pontiac studio.
Dick Teague,
yeah.
Recently a vice president of American Motor Design.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Dick was from California, and I got along good with Dick. Dick liked old automobiles.
Oh, yeah.
He was single at the same time,
mm-hmm.
and one day he said, "Come on over to my place. I've got a room over here on Lothrop, right behind the Fisher Building."
Mm-hmm.
And he was restoring an old 1903 Ford in this lady's garage.
Mm-hmm.
So we went out around the alleyway, and he opened the garage door and went in there, and he was restoring this 1903 Ford.
Mm-hmm.
He showed me his room up there, and we had to enter the door sideways because he had so much automobilia in there and brass lamps stashed behind the door, you could scarcely get into the room. And it's just nuts about this whole thing. That incidentally turned out to be his demise at General Motors, because Art Ross didn't like this sort of thing, didn't like old cars at all. And Dick was always on the telephone, always talking to people about old cars, where to get them fixed, where to locate them, automobile meets and so on. And he was on the phone more than he was designing automobiles. So after, I was in Olds about 1 year when I was moved over to Pontiac studio. And one day,
Before we leave Olds, are you going to continue with Dick?
I'm going to continue with Dick.
Fine.
But I was in Pontiac studio a year later, and Dick came over, rang the bell, said, "Well, Paul," put out his hand, "shake hands, buddy, I'm leaving." I said, "How come?" He says, "God, son of a bitch, Ross fired me."
Mm-hmm.
So Ross fired him up there. He never liked Dick too much anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when Dick Teague left the corporation. Of course, it was better for him, probably he did, considering his fine career at AMC. And I believe he was at Packard and Ford for a while too.
Mm.
He worked around. He had a pretty good background. But you were going to say, what about?
What sort of duties did you have in the automobile studio? What sort of projects did they put you on?
Well, when you started out, you always hear that people were put on wheel discs, or they did door handles, or this
mm-hmm.
sort of thing.
Yeah.
It really wasn't true. You could work on any of those projects, but you did the entire automobile. Wherever the design, whatever part of the car hadn't been completed in design at that time,
mm-hmm.
you were part of the design team to come up with ideas, make sketches.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, they were doing the 48 Olds, 1948 Oldsmobile 98 Futuramic.
Was this to be the first post-war GM
first
car?
Post-war GM car,
which was the
C-body
uh-huh.
at that time.
So they were doing facelifts of the
A-bodies
cars.
In the pre-war cars, the rest of them
yeah.
at that time,
mm-hmm.
which was a very, very minor facelift
right.
they did. However, with this new car, I was put to work on that. I did a lot of the interior work, because in those days, interiors and exteriors were all done in the one studio.
Oh.
They didn't have a special interior department. So I did a lot of the work on the interior. I did the instrument panel, most of the instrument panel, the speedometer cluster, and the arrangement of the knobs down the side and the steering wheel.
Mm-hmm.
I did the lettering on the automobile, and some of the
script.
Script uh-huh. that was it wasn't script we put on the Olds at
that's
that time,
right,
but it was
lettering.
A block lettering that we put up there.
Yeah.
And, so I did all those things. Those were my first projects in Oldsmobile, and it worked out. 1948 Oldsmobile,
mm-hmm.
and when I went over there, I hadn't had any experience in airbrush,
mm-hmm.
so after the war, you couldn't buy airbrushes or any of that sort of thing around
mm-hmm.
Detroit. So I found out the address of Thayer Chandler over in Chicago, called them, and they
Thayer
said,
Chandler?
Thayer Chandler,
mm-hmm.
and they made airbrushes, and they said that they would be there on a Saturday morning. So I got a flight, flew over to Chicago on a Saturday morning, picked up an airbrush and flew back, and had a big tank. I was living with my parents at the time, and I had rented one of these great big air compression tanks.
Mm-hmm.
They brought it into the house, heavy damn thing. And so I got it all hooked up, and I was doing airbrushing at home, practicing on airbrushing. So in my spare time with it, practicing airbrushing at home, I was able to turn out a lot of renderings, a lot more renderings than some of the fellas who were in the studio who were married and, of course, didn't do any work at home at all, only those in the studio. So I kept bringing my work into the studio, and my work looked like twice as much as the rest of them. And I did it mainly not to show up anybody else, but mainly to brush up on airbrushing.
Now, airbrushing at this point, it had begun in the late 30s and early 40s, hadn't it?
Yes.
In a rather primitive way.
Well, it had been used for advertising a great deal, but they used it over at General Motors because a lot of the times they were making full-size renderings of automobiles. And of course, an airbrush, you could put on a nozzle, which would give you a little wider spread than you'd use for close work.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a good way of putting highlights on black paper so that when you stood back and looked at a distance, it looked like a real automobile sitting there, maybe in the dim light.
Yeah.
So I learned airbrushing at that time, but Earl seemed to be impressed with a lot of the work that was going up in there.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately after the war, fellows are just coming back from the Sherbets. Cadillac was run by Bill Mitchell,
mm-hmm.
Olds by Art Ross, Buick by a man named Henry Love,
mm-hmm.
Pontiac by a man named Bob Lauer. Now, Bob Lauer was really an engineer, L-A-U-R, and Lauer had worked for years down at Brewster Body Works before he came to General Motors, an older fellow, worked at Brewster Body Works doing layouts and designing cars down in New York City. And in his spare time, he went to one of the colleges down there and got a degree in design. And so he had done a lot of work for Earl on car work, and Earl liked his background at Brewster Body, so he put him in designing Pontiac cars.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, Lauer wasn't really a designer. He wasn't an artist type of designer, so he had to rely on some other artist to depict what he was putting on paper. And this man was Joe Szymanski, who was his assistant.
How do you spell that?
Szymanski, S-C-H-E. You asked me how to spell Joe Szymanski. It's S-C-H-E-M-A-N-S-K-Y. Joe was Bob Lauer's assistant, and Bob relied very heavily on him because Bob really wasn't an artistic type of designer. He could do line drawings,
mm-hmm.
as they did in the old days at Brewster, but he relied on Joe to make the presentations. However, Earl always felt that Pontiac studio in those days under Lauer looked more like an engineering room than it did a design studio. So that's one of the reasons that they put me in there, because I did a lot of artwork.
Mm-hmm.
So
he needed help
in there at the time. So Earl wanted the studio to be sketch and rendering oriented instead of just profile line drawings filling up the walls. So I soon had it covered with color drawings and sketches, including murals of future products. And Earl was very, very happy with the way the studio looked at that time, so he brought all the top brass in, including all the rest of the chief designers, to see what the way he thought a room really should look. Because up till that time, Bill Mitchell's Cadillac studio was the studio up there, loaded with drawings. In fact, in those days, in order to get, Bill would always try to be flamboyant, so he didn't have sketches tacked on the ceiling, so it looked as though he was really putting out a lot of work in the place. Well,
was this calculated?
It wasn't in
Mitchell's case,
yeah, because Mitchell was a showman, very much like Earl, but he also was smart enough to realize that Earl liked showmanship, and this sort of gave Mitchell the edge up until that time. But at that time, then, he didn't have large murals. I had full-size murals all around the wall. Had the shop people come up while Lara was away and put boards all over the walls. Even part of the walls that were metal had boards put up there, and had full-size murals of automobiles up there with Hawaiian scenes, with searchlights up in the sky with aeroplanes and beautiful girls in cars and all this sort of thing. So it really... The place was more flamboyant than Cadillac Studio in those days, and that's why Earl brought all of his cronies in there to see the place.
he really liked it.
He
would bring them in to
tour
your facility.
Yes,
yeah.
And he liked that. And of course, when Laura got back from vacation and saw this at first, he didn't know what the hell to say, because this was his studio. It didn't look like an engineering room anymore. But as soon as he knew that Earl liked it, then everything was fine.
Right.
Then I was in solid.
Uh-huh.
All that sort of thing. Well, you were asking, Dave, about immediately following the war, what some of the conditions were over General Motors. It was a hectic place in those days, because we were in a hurry to get out the newest cars we could as fast as we could. And of course, they could do it a lot faster in those days than they could today, because the lead time wasn't nearly what it is today.
What was the lead time in those days?
The lead time in those days would be about 16, 18 months to get things done. And why they could tool things up faster in those days, I don't know whether it was a work ethic or labor considerations or what. At any rate, they could do it a lot faster than they can today. All you have to do is consider the when the war came on, the very short time that it took Ford Motor Company to erect the building and start turning out bombers at the end, at the rate of one an hour, about a year and a half after we were into the war.
Right.
Now today, it takes 24 months to start to turn out an automobile, just a facelift on an automobile.
Right.
So in other words, they were doing things a lot faster in those days than they're able to do it today. For some reason, I don't really know why. At any rate, we were scurrying around trying to do all sorts of things. And some of the automobiles in those days, they weren't able to get enough chrome for. So the parts had to be sprayed. The bumpers had to be sprayed. So part of the job was to coordinate the color of the bumper with the cars and the rest of the thing. In those days, also, they couldn't get white wall tires. So they came out with these plastic white wheel rims to put on. And they looked great for a few months until they got all dinged
right.
against the curb and all yellowed and so on. They'd throw them away. But there was a big scurry after the war to get new cars. And the big thing was to get new ideas. And we were always wondering what was going on over at Ford and Chrysler and Packard and Hudson and the rest of them.
Right.
And the big deal in those days was to, if they could, General Motors would, if you knew anybody working over at Hudson's or Packard's, find out what they're doing over there. Talk to the guys. Go to lunch with them. See if you couldn't get a little inkling of what was going on. And so I remember one day...
Genteel espionage.
Genteel espionage, that sort of thing. So I did a grill for Pontiac one time and had a big circle around the center of the thing. It fit in. It was a facelift on one of the Pontiacs. And one of the designers, Melvin Mawinney, who worked in there at the time, quiet little guy, said, well, you know, I've been doing some work in my spare time over at George Walker's studios over in the new center building. And he said, Ford is coming out with a grill just like that. I happened to see a picture over there. So, God, you know, this scared the hell out of me. Here we're releasing engineering drawings on this front end of the Pontiac. With the circle on it. Yeah. So, they called early on it right away. He questioned Mawinney again about the thing. He said, no, that's the way it was. So then Earl called up George Walker. He knew Walker. Mm-hmm. Walker had formerly been with GM years ago. He called Walker and said that he just found that they were working on something like this, and we're doing the same type of thing. How far along are you? And George Walker said, well, hell, we got the thing all ready to go. It's going on the 49 Ford. That's the way it's going to be. So Earl said, Christ, if that's the case, we got to do something else. So we did. We immediately did a quick change, utilizing as much of the old design as we could, and just did something else in the center part of the grill. But this is the type of thing we always had to keep abreast of what else was going on in the car industry.
Now, they were going to have a spinner type.
That's what this
grill.
Yeah.
Was yours pretty much the same?
Yeah, it was pretty much the same.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. The same type of thing.
I guess Joe Oros was partly responsible for that.
I understand that he was too.
Yeah.
At that time, he was with George Walker.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and the thing turned out that way. And of course, it's a natural evolution, you know, to hit on these different themes,
right.
because a lot of the themes you've seen in futuristic drawings that have just appeared publicly in magazines,
uh-huh.
and somebody picks it up and expounds on it, and you come up with a new design along the same lines.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing happened with side treatments of automobiles, interiors, wheel covers, and all the rest of the things on cars.
So it's really just a large fraternity of designers borrowing occasionally from each other in an evolutionary way.
In an evolutionary way, that's the way it would be. You certainly wouldn't, nobody would borrow intentionally on anything
right.
because you wouldn't want to be considered unoriginal,
right.
for one thing, and secondly, it just ethically wouldn't be the thing to do. And so that's the way we worked in those.
But you absorb, really, in a sense, you absorb what's going on in the design world, and it's all into your own design mental matrix, and often something comes out that looks vaguely familiar.
Oh, yes.
Something you've seen.
That happens all the time.
Yeah.
It really does. That's why all the people, the public say, why does this car look like that car? Why does it happen? They must copy from each other. And really, in reality, they don't.
No.
But it's just an evolutionary trend,
sure.
in that it is evolution. It's not a revolutionary thing. If revolutionary thing, the car would look entirely different.
Mm-hmm.
If we're just going to start from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly these things are faceless, or just change the rear fender.
Mm-hmm.
When you get down to it, there's only so many things you can do on the rear fender.
Right.
Or a side treatment of the car and still be within the bounds of decorum. So that's why a lot of the cars, I think, look alike. But those were hectic days, and we had a pretty good time.
One question here at this point, if I may. Harley Earl obviously runs a very tight ship.
Yeah.
Keeps close contact on what's going on. How did the Earl over the Earl proprietorship of the design center, how did he keep things going? Did he have lieutenants who checked on very progress of various designs, or was there an input from the body engineer department and the fledgling product planning group? How did it say?
Well, it changed over the years, of course, naturally, like everything else, but now we're talking about 1947,
yeah.
In the early 40s, when it was known as GM Styling.
Right.
And at that time, at the time I entered GM Styling, they had about 600-700 employees. And that consisted of five studios, each of the car divisions, a wood shop, a metal shop, a plaster shop, and a paint shop. This was the fabrication group. And then an engineering department, draftsmen, mm-hmm. working in there. And then each studio had its own complement of clay modelers. And then there was a body development studio under a man by the name of Vince Kaptur.
And
K-A-P-T-U-R.
Mm-hmm.
Later, his son came in and took over the same studio after mm-hmm. old Cap retired.
Now, what was that their function?
Their function was to do a general body that would be used by all cars. In other words, when we were coming up, we'll say, with the new small body, a new A body for the corporation, a body that would be shared by Chevrolet, Pontiac, Oldsmobile, and sometimes Buick, you'd have to have a common body, but a body that would adapt itself to the individual design of all four divisions. So it's up to the individual studios then, after a body design had been arrived at, to convert it to the four different automobiles, so they all look different. So in the beginning, the body development people got together and worked with the chief engineers of all of the divisions to find out what interior accommodations they want. In other words, some years they may want just a little bit more legroom. Maybe they've gotten a beef that the legroom wasn't enough.
Right.
Maybe they wanted a little bit more hip room or better visibility in the car. So they would make their inputs. The body development studio would then put the Oscar, as they call it, which was the mannequin, in the seats, design the body around there to get all the interior accommodations and exterior accommodations that were required. Then in order to get some design into the car, the three or four divisions sharing the body would send a couple of their designers in to work with the body development group, each working on full-size boards to come up with a new body design that would be pleasing.
When you say full-size boards, you mean wall boards?
Wall boards, yes.
Sketch paper on.
With vellum, sketch paper on it.
Yeah.
So they would lay out the automobile on those. All of these were all divided up in 5-inch grids. And Earl would then spend an awful lot of time in body development studio because, see, this was the architecture of the automobile. You had to have that right. If you didn't have that, you had nothing. So you start with that. And then the foundation of the car, as he called it. And you'd build up from there. Then if you got a car that looked quite good, then he would make prints. And Fisher Body would also be involved in that their engineers would come over and put their inputs into the thing. You know, in the state of the art, there are always changes. Maybe a windshield can be tilted just a little bit more because of the glass that they have now. The old glass, the laminated glass, used to be so thick that you couldn't get much of a tilt on the glass, because if you did, you'd have a distortion, particularly in night driving. So there were all of these parameters that we had to work within. Anyway, when they got a body that looked as though it would be pretty acceptable, then prints were then given to each of the divisional studios to share that body, and they would each come up with their own designs, usually fenders and rear decks and parts of the car to make it individual to the specific division.
You haven't gotten to a Buck or a clay model at this stage, as you're describing.
Not at this time, no. That would come later. And then, but as soon as it starts to look pretty good and everyone likes the look of it, then they would make a Buck.
Uh-huh.
And then it would go down to the wood shop, they would make a seating Buck on the car.
Which would be full size.
Full size, mm-hmm. doors that swing open.
By the way, Oscar mm-hmm. is the famous average American driver, isn't he?
Yeah, 98th percentile driver.
How'd that come about?
I don't know. They had that when I started there. They had Oscar, and Oscar at that particular time was just a plastic figure.
5 foot eight or something like that.
5 foot eight and a half, and
average weight
and height. And later, they all of the divisions got together to work out what they thought was the ideal Oscar. And then they had a regular symposium in which Ford and Chrysler became involved through the Society of Automotive Engineers. And so as a result, they got together with today's Oscar, which is used for all automobile companies. But in the old days, they just had this plastic Oscar that they used to shove in there. And it was different in each of the automobile companies, and it was contrived in the Buy Development Studios.
Can you explain at this time for us that exactly how the ABC body system worked at General Motors after the war?
When I got there, they already had the A, B, and C body system, the three different body sizes.
A, of course, was the...
was the smallest. Yeah. B body was a little bit larger.
What models would be in the A class?
A would be Chevrolet and Pontiac.
Chevrolet and Pontiac.
Yeah. Then later on, they would make the small Oldsmobile with an A, and the small Buick would have the A. But not all years. Some years they would. If the sales weren't good, then they'd drop it for a while. The B body was the small body for, would be the large body for Pontiac and Chevrolet, but was the small body, the B body would be the small body for Oldsmobile and Buick. And then the C body would be the large body, like for the Olds 98, the Buick Electra, and of course the Cadillac. Yes.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
So you would go to a wooden box. That would be the wood studios. You would do that.
Yeah.
They would take the drawings, or the sections of the drawings that applied to the.
Yeah, the engineers would then make the sections. They draw up the buck roughly,
right.
And then they give that to the wood shop, and the wood shop would construct it. They constructed this on a wooden platform, which was the proper height from the ground, which would be to show the proper ground clearance of an automobile. So when you're stepping into it, you'd be stepping in the car at curb height.
Then the buck would be taken, once that was a preliminary approval was given, it would be taken to the clay model shop after that?
You'd have to call all of the engineering groups in. They'd have to look at it and so on. And the chief engineer and the chief body engineer and all their people would come down, and the hangers-on, they'd all come along in the thing to put in their little two bits. And they'd look at the car, they'd sit in it, they'd see how it worked. But at the same time, we had to have different floors in there, because the chief engineers of the divisions would have to supply the tunnel configurations, because each of them had a little bit different tunnel configurations, so they each have to supply that. So we'd have one buck in there with a floor that would be removable, and we'd put the Chevrolet floor in, and then we'd put the Buick floor in the Oldsmobile, and so on, until they got to the point where it cost so much, they decided the best thing to do, they better get together and have a standardization of floors, which they did later on. But to answer your question, after they decided that this looked pretty good, then we started our clay models. And the clay, there would be a clay model going, because it'd be going actually simultaneously with the wood buck, because while the wood buck was being constructed, the modelers were doing the full-size clay.
Now, what frame would they use to put their clay on?
They would make a wooden frame that was probably, 5 to 7 inches
smaller, I see.
So that when the clay was packed on, you could bring it up to the exterior dimensions.
Okay.
And it used to be made of wood with slats all around it. Then it would be shellacked. Then it would be primed with clay, and they packed the clay on. Later years, and now, they use styrofoam. They use a very simple wooden and metal armature. Then it's filled with styrofoam. And then that is then shellacked, and then that's sprayed. Then the clay is then put on that. And it makes it a lot easier because, for example, if you want to use an old armature and make a radical departure, if you want to make a two-door out of a four-door buck, for example, that means that you're going to have to chop part of the backlight away. So you can do that easily in styrofoam, where you couldn't do it in wood. You'd have to take all the clay off that. Woodworkers have to come up, reconstruct another armature right in the studio, and then repack the clay and so on.
Now, is armature another name for a part of a buck?
An armature is any, well, in sculpturing jargon, any sculpture whether he's doing a bust of a person or an automobile or anything, always has to work around a framework. That framework is known as an armature.
It could be any section.
It could be any section then
it
at
could
all.
Be the
it's just a box, really, to pile the clay on, and then
right.
you do the work on the clay.
But it's to spec, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
Or to scale.
It is, so that you don't have to put on too much clay
Good.
To have it too thick.
What type of clay was being used right after the war? Was it a rather awkward?
No, it's a clay that really isn't too much different than it is right now. It was worked by the Chavant Clay Company in New York City. Chavant. And there were different clay companies, but it seems as though Chavant had the inside track with this because it was they developed a clay that was very malleable. It had to be heated. And it was developed pretty much for the automobile industry. So they always keep a clay oven in each studio with huge drawers packed with this clay. And so they pull the clay out. They have clay handlers whose job it is to bring the clay over on little trucks to the armature. And then they have some of the fledgling modelers to pack this on so that the modelers then don't have to go through all the preliminary work, you see.
there's a hierarchy in the modelers.
Oh, yes. There rather is, yeah. Although, you know, if there's not enough help, why anybody will grab it and slap it on.
Right, yeah.
But, yeah, there is. And like in everything else, you know, this fellow's a handler and he hasn't been with them so long.
Mm-hmm.
He's younger and let him bring it over. Yeah.
Sure.
So he learns. So then the modelers then just fit the templates on there.
Now tell me about a template. How does that work?
Templates are templates are made by the wood shop from full-size scale drawings
for
a roof. In other words, that's right, for any part of the automobile. As I said before, these full-size drawings were done on paper that were marked off in 5-inch squares. So first of all, we just do the drawings to rough out and get some ideas. Then we put it on very, very carefully on 5-inch squared drawing paper. Once it's on there, you have a reference so that when you want to make a template of a car, you know precisely what the numbers are, and you can fit these templates. So there's a section every 5 inches.
You mean dimensions.
Dimensions. So that what you can do is every 5 inches, you get a contour, a different contour in the automobile, both longitudinally and horizontally. So by doing it this way, you have a cross section every 5 inches. By then, with this supply of templates fit it onto the clay model, you merely have to scrape off the area in between and you've got the shape. So
the template gives it through being a scale drawing.
Scale interpretation of the full size drawing.
Gives you the actual contour of the part.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Because you see it on drawing and it looks very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're making a drawing, a real good draftsman can draw a front view of the car on this scale drawing showing all these 5-inch sections all the way down the car.
Mm-hmm.
So that as you look at it, if you have a real good eye, you can just interpret what the section of the automobile is going to be. And if you look in all three views, you can get a very good idea. Earl had a very uncanny way of looking at these drawings and knowing what the car was going to look like. But Earl could not sketch. He was not a sketch type of artist. He couldn't come up with ideas in sketch form. He was good on full-size work. He could look at the full-size drawings, and as I understand it, in his dad's early automobile company out in California doing custom bodies, this is what he was used to doing, not sketches and coming up with wild ideas that way. So he would work with his full-size draftsman out there, and that's what they would work on. So this is what he was used to doing. But then it had to be put in 3D, in clay, so that you could see how it looked. But when you see it in 3D, oftentimes it looks more bulbous, or you have hollow sections, and it doesn't look nearly as good as you'd find on the drawing. So then you'd have to scrape off a little here, a little there, and change the whole car. And when you're finished with a full-size clay drawing, it really is a great deal different than the original full-size line drawing that it was taken from. And then after we'd get the full-size clay model completed, we used to slick it down and get a real slick section so it looked, you could see the highlights on the thing. And then they used to go over now they put on what they call Dynoc on it.
How do you spell
it? Dynoc, D-I, probably apostrophe NOC, or hyphen NOC. And at any rate,
that was the trade name.
It's probably the trade name of the stuff. It's a real thin plastic film. They spray it any color you want in the shop, and then they give this to the modelers, and the modelers take sections of this Dynoc, this thin film, and they wet it. It's very malleable, and they just then take slicks, small plastic squares, run over it and over the surface, and it adheres to the surface of the automobile. And so when it's all done, you know, even around compound surfaces, they're very, very good at cutting out little wedges and slicing it, and that being very, very thin, one piece can go over the other without actually showing any depth of surface. And they'll do that until the entire car appears to be painted. Then we take the car outside to look at it at a distance in comparing with other automobiles.
When you say take it outside, does it have wheels and tires, and can it be pulled?
No, as I said before, it is this is built on a platform, and the platform has small casters under it so that it can be transported outside.
At this point, are you using a bridge in the clay modeling department? Could you tell us a little bit what a bridge is and what it does?
Yes. Well, to begin with, all clay models are built within a platform. A platform is a metal plate which surrounds the entire car. The platform is measured off in inch lines, so that when you fit these templates to the clay model, you have lines of reference to set the templates, and they have these metal plates, platforms, and then when they want to put a bridge across an automobile, they just measure. They have this bridge that fits across the automobile, and comes down each side and fits on the plate. It moves fore and aft, so that you can take your points on the model to correspond to the points on a full size drawing.
Now, a bridge is something that allows you to get the proper shape.
Yes.
To the automobile.
That's right. In the early days, they didn't have those. They had a bridge, but you just on the bridge, you'd fit your templates. You'd fit your roof template on there. You'd fit your body template on there. And then you just scrape the clay down to fit the contour of the template. But nowadays, they have bridges, and the bridges have probes, and the probes are actually like small needles. We'll say like a size of a knitting needle. And these can be all pushed in or out all the way around. You pull them out, and so you can take the probe and set the probe to the outline that you desire on the clay model, right from the drawing. And then this bridge fits over the automobile, and this takes the place of templates. It's a speedy way of transposing the drawings to the shape of the car in clay.
It gives you your coordinates.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. When did that come into general use? Was it there when you got there in the mid-40s?
No, it wasn't. We didn't have a complete bridge in those days either. No, we'd have in the early 40s. They used to have a platform around the car. These metal platforms, and of course the plates had to be removable at each end, so you could withdraw the model when you wanted to take it out for observation outside. But in those days, they used to just have surface plates that they would put up against the side, which measuring increments on it that would move up and down. And then, of course, from there, they would, if they wanted a bridge across the car, the two would be interconnected as a template.
When do you remember bridges coming into general use again?
Bridges came into General Motors, general use, probably not till about 1965, 66. Pardon?
Your
hand. Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. Mm-hmm. 1965. Not until 1965.
Not 1965 that they used the full bridges. Ford Motor Company, as I understand it, used it much before that.
Did they?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
I think they had the jump on General Motors in that regard.
Did they?
Yeah.
It was much more convenient, wasn't it?
Oh yes, it was.
Accurate.
Yeah. Sure, because you didn't have to move the surface plates on each side.
Yeah.
You just fell on each side of it and move the entire deal, and you had both sides of the automobile at one time. Instead of one side, it was twice as fast, really. But of course, nowadays they do it a little bit differently. They use what they have an electronic system there, which they set up, and it's a point-taking system. And so they just touch the car at these various points on the side of the automobile, press a button, and it's immediately goes on a tape, and it's all electronically recorded. And then it's similar to a videotape,
yeah.
But then you can just run this videotape, and the tape can go through and can be used on the drafting machines, and it's transposed from the tape to the paper. So you've got just your new surfaces, which you've developed in clay, then go right into the drafting. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't need draftsmen, because they always have to clean up the lines. But
right.
This means generally you've got the points pretty accurately taken.
That takes out a lot of work, doesn't
it? Oh, definitely does, yeah. It makes the process a lot faster, which makes you wonder why the lead time is longer than it used to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been very, very diverting. Thank you. The late 40s, you're in the Pontiac studio, and you're working directly for Bob Lauer. Obviously, you and Mr. Lauer got along fairly well.
Yes, Bob was a very nice man. He was a gentleman,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to a lot of them who weren't, or people in general who aren't.
Yeah.
Bob was always a gentleman, got along with everyone very, very well. Everyone liked him,
mm-hmm.
and particularly the people up at Pontiac, the engineering people up there, they liked him because he was an engineer, he talked their language, and these kooky guys down at Styling, they're all right, but Bob was an engineer, and they had more rapport with Bob. The Pontiac group up there was a little unique, I guess, over some of the divisional people, in that they were a close-knit group. There were a lot of older engineers working up there. And it was known as sort of an old fuddy-duddy group. Mr. Earle used to refer to them as that group anyway. The chief engineer up there at that time, there'd been a man named Ben Annabelle, but he retired. And A-N-I-B-E-L. And he was well thought of in the automobile industry. In fact, after he retired, General Motors put him over to England on a consulting basis to develop a lot of Vauxhall's engines. And he's a very, very smart man. However, George Delaney came in then to be chief engineer.
Delaney or
Delaney? Delaney, D-E-L-A-N-E-Y. And George was a very, very good engineer, very capable man, an unflappable sort of a guy. But he used to wear high white collars, and he used to wear high shoes.
Really?
Yeah, mm-hmm. And this dated the guy, naturally. And Earl just couldn't stand this sort of thing. He couldn't stand Delaney just because of his appearance.
Mm-hmm.
And then Delaney always smoked a great big cigar, and his teeth matched the color of the cigar. And he wasn't smoking it, he'd chew it. Yeah. And of course, he wore a hat a lot of the time, because it seems like in the old days in the automobile industry and walking through the shops, the only way that the workers could tell the bosses was that they were wearing hats.
So he's definitely, by this time, an
anachronism. Right.
Especially to Harley Earl.
Yeah. Then his assistant, who was chief body engineer, was named Roy Milner. And Roy Milner was one of what they called the four horsemen. There was Annabelle, there was Milner, there was a couple other guys whose name I forget. It was long before my time.
Mm-hmm.
But they had worked at through the big P companies. They'd worked at Peerless, Piercero, and Pontiac, and they were all there. So, and Roy Milner was in there. Roy was also a gentleman, all white-haired guy, straight back, came in, and when they were getting, both smoked cigar smokers, and when they got together at a meeting, it was Dullsville, really. And then their cronies around there, Art Sharp and some of the rest of them that brought in, they were the same caliber. It didn't mean that they weren't smart. They were very intelligent guys. They weren't avant any means in their engineering ideas, and I think Pontiac was lagging behind. Yeah. In the car business.